Hey everyone, on this episode we have head coach Lindsay Woolley of the University of Montana Western. Coach Lindsay has been the head coach of Montana Western since 2012. He's led his team to placing top three in the Frontier Conference the last 3 years, winning it in the 2018-2019 season, an NAIA National Championship in the same season, and appearing in the NAIA National Tournament 4 times. He has an overall head coaching record of 155-99, and his team achieved the highest national ranking in school history at number 3 in the nation. Coach Lindsay has been named the Frontier Conference Coach of the Year 3 times straight, and was named the WBCA NAIA National Coach of the Year in the 2018-2019 season. On this episode, Coach Lindsay talks about lessons learned early in his career, challenges his team overcame to win a national championship, and more. Let's roll it back and hear how the conversation went. So coach, tell me, how did you get into coaching and when did you know that this was what you wanted your career to be?
Well, the first time I coached was between my sophomore and junior years of college, maybe my freshman and sophomore year. I can't remember exactly. I started doing camps. And so I did 4 or 5 camps that summer, just as something to do and just a little something on the side for work and those types of things, and really started to enjoy it. And that's kind of where the bug first kind of bit me. And then kind of as I progressed through my college career, when I got really between my junior and senior year was when I did an internship, because I was an engineering student. And after 50-hour weeks all summer long, I decided I didn't want to be an engineer anymore. And that's kind of what kind of pushed me along the path to kind of where I got to. And so coached a little bit of high school, 8 years of junior college, now 9 years. This will be year 9 at the NAIA level. So it's been basically all coaching since I was, 24 years old.
Wow, an engineer, really. That's the route you were going to take. That's amazing.
Yeah,
it's hard.
I wanted to be a poor basketball coach at the small college level.
More fulfilling, right?
It's definitely more fulfilling. Yes, it's, you know, monthly when we get the paycheck, it doesn't always add up the way you want it to. But it's in terms of, you know, having a little bit of time for your family in the summers and those types of things. And, you know, in terms of being able to, you know, almost be your own boss in a way, there's definitely those benefits. And then of course, getting to be around our kids every day for, you know, 2 to 3 hours, depending on what we're doing, and developing those relationships and watching them grow is certainly about as rewarding a profession as you can find, in my opinion.
Oh, totally. I completely agree. Earlier in your career as an assistant coach, what were some of the tasks that you found pretty challenging?
Oh, there's a lot. I mean, I was really fortunate when I got into coaching at Miles Community College. I had a coach who kind of let me do everything, and really just kind of turned me loose to figure it out on my own in a way. So that was challenging in and of itself. Recruiting was challenging to me because I was so close in age to some of the kids that we were recruiting and talking to. Mm-hmm. You know, finding the common ground wasn't hard, but just kind of relaying it back into getting the message across that we need to get across as recruiters was challenging to me. There was lots of other things too. I mean, when I started coaching, we were still doing stuff off of DVD. we purchased an editing box. We called it the Blue Box. I can't even remember who made it, but so I had to cut all the film, whether it was practice or games or whatnot, that now Synergy does for us, or Huddle, or whoever college coaches use, and high school coaches. So I was doing all of that, and then, you know, tagging it, organizing it, doing all those types of things. So it was extremely time consuming. I feel about where you have such a benefit now with just sending it off, and 24 hours later we got back and it's exactly how we want it, and we can watch stuff with our kids, you know, almost on demand. It's almost like another assistant coach. So that was hard. I think that one of the hardest things as a young assistant coach was probably the relationships with players, and being able to have the coach relationship yet still have a good personal relationship with them. And I do the same thing with my assistant now. Is she's supposed to kind of have a pulse on their life, even a little bit more so than me. And but still be able to keep it separate and still be able to command respect on the practice floor and those types of things. So I really think the relationship piece of it is the hardest part, especially as a young assistant coach. Now that I'm older, it's not that hard, but I remember when I was, you know, 23 to 27 years old, it was much more challenging than it is now.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, I got my first start coaching at the college level right after I was done playing at Vanguard. I was the GA at Concordia University, and some of the girls on the team I had played against from when I was at Vanguard. So it was definitely, it was interesting to kind of find that fine line between, hey, I know that we played against each other, but I'm actually, you know, I'm your coach now. Whereas it's a little bit easier now, even now, you know, I'm still young, but, I'm not, you know, 21 years old. So it's a little different. And it, as you get older, I'm sure you can attest to this. It just gets easier and easier to distance yourself as far as, that relationship goes.
Yeah. And I do. I think, it's definitely a time where you have to lean on your head coach and, you know, some of your coaching colleagues that, you know, that are, you know, that are older, that have been through it, because there's no blueprint, there's no book on the right way to do it. And we certainly all make mistakes along the way and just have to do our best to learn from them and own up to them with your players, to try to just move forward and help the team be as best they can be.
We talked about challenges earlier on in your career. How about some mistakes? What are some mistakes that you made and how did you learn from them?
There's a book of them, Sammy. I actually have on my Outlook, I have a note that's always up. That's, you know, I just have, like, whether it's notes from last year, but I have my mistakes tab that I just keep adding to every year. Sometimes daily, sometimes weekly. And then you can read back over them and like, yep. I think some of the mistakes I made early was I just wanted to give our kids all the answers as quickly as I could. And sometimes, even though you may have the answers, getting the answers across to them just cluttered their mind. And so while I was always trying to give them answers, they weren't seeking for solutions. And so so the learning was different. And I think that slowed them down. And I think that's pretty common, right? Like, we spend, you know, especially yourself as a young coach, imagine you spend a lot of time watching film and you see a lot of different things, whether it's on TV or on Twitter or various websites. And there's so much information out there now that sometimes it clutters your mind as a coach, and you think too much about, oh, well, this defense would be good for us and this defense would be good for us. And same thing on the offensive end of the floor. And really what you find is, the longer you do it, that just being really good at the few things that you do, whether it's offensively or defensively, is really ultimately what leads to success and allowing your kids to play faster and play with more freedom and all those types of things. Because if they're constantly thinking, then they're ultimately slower. And so that's probably the biggest mistake. And I still do it. I mean, I still see stuff that I think, oh, that's really good. And then I'm always reeling myself back saying, nope, less. And, you know, just try to do a good job of teaching the simple things and the concepts that we like and that our kids are familiar with, and then giving them some options out of those concepts. So that's a big one. I mean, I think that's huge. I think, you know, I think all young coaches make the mistake of probably being a little bit too gung-ho and a little bit too hard on their players at times, or not being hard enough and finding that balance of what's your personality and, you know, what are you going to stand for? What are your absolutes, non-negotiables, whatever word it is that you want to use. I think sometimes that our brain moves a little bit too fast when we're a young coach, and that we don't really know what we stand for yet, no matter how much we've thought about it, until you actually get into practice and games, it's hard for you to figure it out. It's a little bit of trial by fire.
Yeah, I really do completely agree. I mean, I have changed already so much of how I want to coach and the style of coaching, defenses I like and things like that. And, you know, 3 years from day one as a head coach to now, it's just been completely different, because I haven't really figured out, you know, what I'm in love with. But I do love quick hitters, but, you know, I'm still right there with you as far as I can't have too many. I don't want to overwhelm these girls. So there definitely is a fine line between seeing a good play and wanting to add that to your arsenal and thinking, wait, you know what? I think we're good right now. We have enough going on.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what you'll find too is, you know, as you get into kind of more of your recruiting niche, and I know at the junior college level, you're obviously just, you know, you're just spanning the area and trying to find the best kids that you can, but you'll start getting drawn to certain kids that will play the way that you want your team to play. And I think until you know that, it's really hard to kind of narrow your scope in recruiting and be able to say, oh yeah, that's a kid. She reminds me of so-and-so that was really good in this part of our offense or defense. And that it just, you know, it's things with experience that come that you might not necessarily be able to do, you know, starting from year one.
Right. So you've coached men at the collegiate level, and now you're currently coaching women. So I would love to know, and for anyone listening, what do you think are the biggest differences specifically at the collegiate level between coaching men and women?
The biggest difference is with men, I felt like I had to go to practice every day and be ready to motivate my team. And we had good teams, we had bad teams, and it was all the same. It was how do we get them to go as hard as we want them to go all the time? How do we get them to buy into the team concept, because they're inherently more selfish? And so it's almost like you're trying to reframe their mindset into, you know, giving a little bit more towards the team concept and having a little bit more energy towards their teammates' success and those types of things. Whereas on the women's side, it's in a way, it's almost the opposite, is they're inherently unselfish for the most part. And so now you're trying to remind them that they should be confident, you're trying to give them more confidence and more freedom to go out and make basketball plays, as we like to say. And so that's the biggest difference. For me personally, I just like being around women a lot more than I like being around the men, to be honest with you. It was evident to me with the first year that I coached women, after 2 weeks, that my personality fit better with them than it did with on the men's side. I just didn't have that demeanor and swag and all that stuff that you typically see on the men's side from really successful coaches. I just don't. It's just not my personality. And so I really meshed better with the women, I thought. And I just, for me personally, I enjoyed it a lot more.
Mm-hmm. What was your approach going into year one at the University of Western Montana when you were hired back in 2012?
It was really, you know, we were fortunate that we had a pretty good core of kids coming back. We had a senior that was I think she was a second team All-American, maybe third team. She averaged a double-double the previous 2 years. So we were going to build around her. She ended up tearing her ACL in August on a foreign tour, July, I guess, in July on a foreign tour. And so I actually never got to coach her. But we still had good pieces. So I was really just trying to impart my system, which I think was – looking back on it, you could probably go either way. You could say, well, it was a mistake in that, you know, you should try to build your system around your players. But for me, I was trying to establish our program, the things that we wanted to do. So I really wanted to install my system of offense and defense. And it probably wasn't the best for that group. And I figured it out. But it took 10, 12 games before we started changing what we did offensively, because the way that I wanted to play, we couldn't play because we didn't have enough shooting. We didn't really have multiple point guards, and so I had to change. And so we kind of figured it out as we went. But the biggest thing for me was just establishing relationships and making sure that they understood what I stood for and what I wanted. And then a lot of it was just, I'm just going to evaluate these kids as the year go. And so I can be honest with them in postseason meetings in terms of, you know, this is what we need from you, and this is what we're looking for out of these positions and those types of things. I think we're fortunate at the NAIA level, small college level, that it's not necessarily always about winning, especially right away, which is much different than, you know, obviously the higher up you get into Division I, where it's like, well, now you're getting paid to win, so you need to figure it out. So you don't necessarily have to cut kids right away. and fill them with different kids. And so we certainly didn't do that here. And I don't believe that that's the right way to do it at our level. You just work with the kids that you have and they become yours, excuse me. And then you just continue to create some competition for them on the roster so they understand what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. That answer your question. I kind of went off tangent there.
Well, you're kind of leading into the next question that I have for you. So I may have you just add to that a little bit, because you talked about how you essentially had a change, you know, 12 games in. Mm-hmm. But now here we are about 8 years later. How has your style of coaching or even your philosophy changed since that first year?
I'm not sure that my style has changed so much in terms of how I teach. And, you know, like, I still believe in teaching the same way that I did, you know, 8, 10, 12 years ago. I think my coaching philosophy has definitely changed. I think that it's, and I think it always is ever evolving. I mean, I have a document just like I do on my notes with philosophy stuff, because it does always change. I've had teams that, you know, we played a ton of zone and shot it and got the ball inside, excuse me. And then we've had teams that played all man and shot a bunch of threes. We've had teams that pressed and played zone. I've continued to just try to bend it to our kids as best that we can. I think your philosophy's always got to be ready to change, but you know, there's a few couple different zones that I'm comfortable teaching. And so those are the ones that we go to. And there's a couple ways that I like to press that I'm comfortable teaching. So that's what we use. I think offensively, probably just like everybody else, you know, we've really, you know, changed our recruiting to only signing kids that can shoot the three, or signing kids that we think will be able to shoot the three better, you know, in a year or two. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with their shot, those types of things. I've spent a lot more time teaching and emphasizing passing in practice, because I thought it was an area that we were poor at. And I think it's just an area where kids are probably poor at. You know, we rely a lot on kids being able to pass, dribble, and shoot. And so that's where we spend a lot of our time. We probably do a lot more skill stuff now than we did when I first got here. When I first got here, I thought coming to from the junior college level to the four-year level, I thought, you know, we've got a bunch of kids that just love being in the gym all the time. And I was wrong. We had to kind of make them get in the gym. And now we've kind of changed, our culture has changed to where we have kids where, yes, we make them do shooting workouts with partners or whatnot, but they want to be in there. And, you know, we really have probably 7 or 8 kids that love being in the gym. And then that brings along the next 3 or 4 that, you know, could go either way. And the kids that don't want to be kind of just weed themselves out and start to figure it out. And so that's been another part of my philosophy that's changed in terms of, like, we still have to give them the platform to get better. They don't necessarily go in there just on their own and shoot around like I assumed that they would moving up a level, so to speak.
Right. I think that's where that the difference between men and women come back into play, because on the men's side, you probably didn't have to force them to get in, you know, extra shots or training and things like that. They were just always in the gym.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That's another piece of it. The guys are always, they seem to always be, you know, and same thing. It's a few of them. It's not all of them, but they're in working on their games. And until we got, you know, it took us a few years of giving our kids stuff to do. But, you know, once we gave them stuff to do and said it was expected, then we didn't have a problem for them getting in the gym and being on their own. Because obviously with every level has their different advantages or disadvantages in terms of being able to be with their kids and work out. But, you know, we're able to, even though we don't start doing anything by NAIA practice 24-week guidelines, or 24-week, our kids will still get in there and work on the stuff that they worked on in the summer without a coach. And so that's, mm-hmm. I think that's a big part of having a little bit of success.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting a sense that you do a lot of self-assessment, you know, based on you tracking your mistakes, and it's pretty much there right in front of your face every time you open your computer, and tracking mm-hmm. your philosophy change and things like that. So what does that stem from? Like, where did that come from, this whole idea of, let me just jot down all my mistakes and be able to look at it every day and see how I add or how I've learned to the, from them?
It's a good question. I don't know. I probably can't pinpoint a specific, you know, where. I'm sure I heard it at a clinic or something somewhere along the way. I don't remember exactly where I heard it from. It was something that I started about 7 years ago with the mistakes document, that like my postseason, like every year with my postseason thoughts document. It's just something that I have open all the time, so I can always go back to it and just read it. It takes 30 seconds to 2 minutes, depending on how closely I want to read it. I, you know, probably, like I said, it either comes from a clinic or it came from a book that I read somewhere along the line. And I just adapted it to what I needed it more. I thought I was, you know, needed help and those types of things. It's probably no different than when you sit down with your AD at the end of the year and go over, what did you do well? What did you do poorly? Excuse me. And do that evaluation. I think it's, you know, if I can, I'm sure that when I evaluate myself, just like when I have my players evaluate themselves, I'm much harder on myself than my AD probably ever would be, or anybody outside of our program. So I just think it's helpful. It's just a good reminder to, you know, keep moving forward and always try to find a way to get better.
Yeah, definitely. I think I might actually steal that from you. Although I will say that it's going to fill up pretty quickly if I include last year's mistakes.
Well, didn't you only have like 5 players last year? You couldn't have made that many mistakes.
Yeah, I did. On a good day, I had 5. Oh man. Yay! All right. So I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know much about the Frontier Conference. I know a lot about the GSAC, obviously, because that's the conference I played in. But from what I understand, the Frontier Conference is pretty darn difficult to be successful in. It's right up there with the GSAC, and maybe you have your bias and think it's harder than the GSAC. I don't know, yeah. But you've won it 3 times in a row. So how have you managed to keep your team so consistent with that?
Well, we haven't won it. We've been in the top 2 the last 3 years. We have not won it all 3 years, unfortunately. We gave away an opportunity, but that's irrelevant. We have been pretty consistent the last few years. I think I think with the Frontier, the thing that makes it hard, and it's different, like I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the Frontier is better than the GSAC or the Mid-South or the Red River or whatever. What I'll tell you that is different, that I think is true, is like in our league that right now, we had 7 teams till LC State left this past year to go to the Cascade. Now we only have 6, but the difference between the Frontier and every other team in women's basketball at the NAIA level is 1 through 6 can win on any given night. And, you know, I think you can remember back to when you were playing at Vanguard, like you knew when you went to certain schools, like we're going to win and we're probably going to win by 25 or Russ is going to be really pissed. And so in the last 5 years, we haven't had that case with our last place team. And so that in itself leads you to kind of developing a mindset within your players of consistency and understanding that if they don't show up, they're going to get beat. They could get beat by 20 if they don't show up. And so mm-hmm. I think the league lends itself to some consistency. I think for us, our consistency has come from us just being comfortable in who we are and understanding who we are and playing with a chip on our shoulder. We have a group of kids that not a lot of them got recruited by a lot of schools in our league. And so they have that motivation when they play the other schools in our league, and they're just very, very process oriented. And they understand that we're just trying to get better every day. And, you know, last year, I think we were picked 6th out of 7 teams and we were in first place going into the last game and got beaten double overtime, or else we won a league championship. And I think that's just because our kids have that mentality all the time of trying to be better and constant improvement. And they're very, very comfortable in how we play and what we want.
Oh, that's great. I hope this fact that I'm about to spit out is actually a fact, but in 2019, so last year, you actually won the NAIA National Championship, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's amazing. Absolutely just amazing. What challenges did your team have to overcome to do that?
Well, there was a few. I mean, there wasn't a ton. I think honestly, we go back to our league being really competitive from top to bottom. That was probably the first thing that helped us. And I know this doesn't answer your question, but we were coming off of 2018, we went to the Final 4 and got beat. by Freed, who ended up winning it a couple nights later. And we were picked second in our league. And I think that helped our kids because, like I said earlier, like they always kind of have a bit of a chip on their shoulder. And I know that that put a chip on their shoulder. You know, and then you look at when the national rankings come out and we're ranked somewhere in the, I don't know exactly where we were, but we were in the mid-teens probably. And I know that ticked them off too, because we had four starters back and our top two bench kids back off a team that got beat in the Final Four. So that right there was the first piece that helped them, I think, because I know it's much different when you come out and you're ranked one, two, or three, and the target is different as you move into that next season, because we saw it in 2020, right? So that was definitely a big piece of help. I think the first piece of adversity we had was our point guard's mom got in a really bad car accident in the fall before we started practice, and it was touch and go on whether or not she was going to come back to school. And she was she was the NAIA player of the year. She was probably the best player that's ever played at our school. And so our kids knew her importance to our team, as well as the importance for getting a degree. But that was the big piece. And you know, that was about a 2-week period where we weren't sure she was going to come back and play with us. So that was certainly challenging. I think the next one is, you know, when you lose, it sounds kind of weird, but when we lost our first game, because I think they had gotten to a point where they didn't think they were going to lose a game. And I think we were, I don't know, for 18-0, 19-0. We got beat on the road at Great Falls. And that was a kind of a shell-shocked moment for them. And it sounds weird because I'd never had a team that had won that many games in a row to start a year. And so we didn't know. We just weren't sure how they were going to respond. And the next game, they started off slow, and we thought maybe that, you know, maybe we're going to lose two in a row, even though it was a game that we probably should have won. And they mentally were able to flip the switch and get some momentum going back on their side. I think probably the third one that I can remember back to is when we got to February, we had, you know, I'm sure you can remember, whether it's your coaching or when you're playing, you get to February and you're just crossing your fingers, hoping that your team doesn't get sick, right? Like, because, you know, if one or two get sick, it's probably going to work its way through three quarters of your roster. And we got sick with about 2 weeks left in the regular season and dropped a couple games. And they happened to be at home, but it was just one of those times where we couldn't get everybody healthy. We'd have two starters that were sick, or three, or all of our bench kids. And it just kind of ran through us for a two or three week stretch. And I think that it was certainly eye-opening for them in terms of rest and recovery and all those types of things, but it was definitely challenging because it makes you second guess yourself when you're rolling and you're winning and all of a sudden you start seeing some adversity. It definitely tests your mettle a little bit, but they definitely kept staying process approached and just moving on to the next game. And that was probably the next biggest obstacle. And then I think you just, with our league, we play everybody three times. Now this year we're gonna play everybody four times, but we typically play everybody three times and we get to the conference playoffs, we play everybody again. I think that wears on your kids. I think reminding your kids that, you know, it is a process, and obviously, you know, we get to the postseason and you have the challenges of trying to win a postseason conference title on top of a regular season conference title. And, you know, it's a benefit knowing that you're probably going to the tournament anyway. But it's just that mental grind of how long the year was. I remember saying to my assistant after we got beat at home in the conference championship game, and obviously our kids were upset and all those types of things, but we took about 3 days off before we practiced again. And when they came back, they had a renewed sense of energy that I hadn't seen from them since we started practice back in October. And it was interesting. Like, we got done with our first practice and my assistant's just like, man, he's like, it's like a different team. I'm like, yeah. And you would have thought, you know, they were still crushed or whatnot, but it was almost like a new season for them. They're like, hey, we don't have to play somebody from the Frontier for the third or fourth or fifth time. And so I think that just having that kind of that breath of fresh air really kind of catapulted them. And then obviously they were confident and felt confident going into the tournament. And, you know, then you have, you know, the challenges that getting through five games in 7 days presents itself. You know, we played, what do we get? We got the Masters in the third round, and, you know, you look across their starting lineup and they're 6'8", 6'3", 6'1", 6 foot, 5'9", and we're like 5'11", 5'10", 5'6", 5'4", 5'6". So, jeez, you know, it's such a different contrast in styles. And, you know, we had some kids make big plays for us in tournament games that had made big plays all year, but it was obviously magnified on a bigger stage. And then we get freed in the semis again. And I think we were down 7 with 40 seconds to go. And, you know, played the foul game and got lucky they missed a couple, and we scored every time. And then you hit a 3 at the buzzer. And once we got to overtime with Freed, you could tell that our kids were, once again, still just process approach and extremely confident in knowing what they're going to do. We win by 7, and then a couple nights later get Oklahoma City. And once again, it's another huge size mismatch like we had with the Masters. And our kids just didn't blink one time and just said, you know, it's fine that we don't have anybody that's within 6 inches of their tallest player, and we'll just go in and just play our game, and got off to a really good start and really just cruised. Our kids were extremely confident, and I was certainly impressed with how they were able to respond. And, you know, to be able to do it in the state of Montana in front of 5,000-6,000 fans was pretty cool for them. And I know it's a moment that they won't forget, but it had its challenges. It's such a long year. You're going to have them. And I think, you know, it's just like anything else, how you respond and how you rebound from those hard times is really what defines your character.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds like such an amazing run, like a storybook ending. Seriously, that is so cool, especially coming back down 7 with 40 seconds left. I mean, Freed must have just been so upset afterwards, just, you know, when it comes down to free throws and things like that. I can't even imagine. Yeah. Earlier on in your answer, you mentioned, you know, being undefeated, going, I think you said 18 or 19 and 0, and then losing and not really knowing how your team is going to respond. It's kind of interesting is, you know, for coaches that maybe haven't done it, or players that haven't been on an undefeated team, on the outside looking in, that's just so cool, right? Like, oh yeah, they're undefeated, they have the streak going.
Yeah, but how hard can it be, right?
But from a coaching standpoint especially, it's a really scary thing, because there's this pressure of, once that loss does happen, like you were saying, it's like, now you know your team, at least from a player standpoint, I can say this, you're like, well, I guess we aren't the best, you know, like we got beat. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of self-assess, and then it's like the streak is broken and everyone thinks it's about a streak. And it's just, it's really a being undefeated is great, but it's also, it can be scary if you don't stay undefeated.
There's no question. And I had never done, you know, we'd have winning streaks and got off to good starts, but to sit there and say, well, we're whatever an O, it's way more stressful to be 17, 18 and 0 than it is to be 12 and 5. Like it's not even close. Now, if you're 0-17, it's probably just as stressful as it is to be 17-0. But it's just like you said, it mounts. It just continues to mount. And as coaches, you try to take it off your kids, but you know that it's weighing on them a little bit. And like you said, like to self-assess and reassess. And like, you know, I think sometimes we can get a little bit too caught up in, you know, you lose a game that you might over-assess on your weakness. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, maybe it's just, we just were bad, or the other team was really, really good. You know, they shot it well, they had a couple kids, you know, maybe they made shots that they usually don't make, which is often what happens when you're playing good teams and you're trying to knock them off. So sometimes I think you can over assess and over analyze what went wrong, instead of just letting your kids clear your mind and just start over the next day. Like, you know, we're right back to what we do always in practice. We're gonna work on offense, we're gonna work on defense, work on fundamentals, and go from there, and not really worry too much about, and not kind of keep it in their mind in terms of, well, this is why you lost, you know, and pinpoint one specific reason. Because as you know, with basketball, like, it could be a multitude of reasons that we can't even control.
Oh, totally. And like you're saying, as far as over assessing, I mean, any team that goes undefeated for, you know, 5 games, 10 games, 15, 20, whatever, that's a good team. So you have a target on your back, just like you do when you're top 5 in the nation and some team that's not ranked or is, you know, rated lower than that plays you. Everybody wants to beat the number 5 team, the number 1 team, the undefeated team. And most of the time you lose that streak, you become no longer undefeated, because your opponent shot the best they will ever shoot all season. That's usually what happens. So yeah, I mean, you're 100% right that sometimes, you know, the self-assessment is, well, they just shot the lights out because they wanted it so bad. And we did, you know, everything we could or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. And I think it's important. It's okay to allow your kids to see that and to allow them to hear you say that. I know sometimes, you know, we're all competitive and we all want to win every game and all that good stuff that goes into one of the reasons that we decided to pursue this crazy profession. But I think you have to show some vulnerability to your kids at times in terms of, you know, yeah, did we turn it over 0 times? No, we turned it over 12 times. And that's, you know, maybe it's a couple more than we want to, or whatever the case may be, and things that you can point to in a loss. But you can also just let them know, like, if you thought it was true, you know, I thought your effort was good and you got down 10 and you battled back and you cut it to 2 and you gave yourself opportunities, and still try to highlight some positives. And I know that that might sound like fluffy and marshmallowy, but that's, I still think that, you know, like I said earlier, always trying to find subtle ways of building our kids' confidence. And whether it's as a group or as an individual, I think you can always find something, whether it's a 20-point loss or a 20-point win. Well, with a 20-point win, you typically don't have to, but, you know, on things, you can get a read on your team in terms of how emotionally upset they are after a loss. And then you have to find a way, is how do we get them to rebound? Because, you know, you have another game coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. And when they are visibly emotionally upset, I don't think that that is the time to just rip them a new one and make it that much worse for them.
For sure. The point is already gotten across. And then all we're doing as coaches is making ourselves feel better, which is a little on the selfish side. And it certainly isn't teaching anybody anything other than maybe giving your players a story to tell later on in life. I'm sure we all have those, don't we, Sammy? Of course, Russ, he never yelled at you guys.
I've never seen him raise his voice, not once. Nope. Are you kidding me? You know, Russ, if the other team scores the first time in the game, he's using a timeout.
Right.
No question. If we don't score first, you just go ahead to the bench because you know there's a timeout that's about to be called by Coach Russ Davis. Gotta love him. All right, so this season coming up, especially with COVID-19 and how unique of a situation we're all in, how fluid this situation is, what's your approach for this coming season?
Well, it's changed. I mean, as the winds of COVID change, we've certainly tried to be adaptable. And that's really kind of what we stress to our kids, is just, we're going to try to adapt to this thing daily, weekly, as things change, whether it's protocols to return to play or testing protocols or canceling of games, addition of games. I mean, our conference schedule has changed like 4 times, and I think it's going to change again here in the next couple of weeks, it sounds like. It's just, it's different than what we're the normalcy, that the pattern of the season, right? Like, you start practice and you practice for 3 or 4 weeks, and then you might have a scrimmage or two. And then you start your season and you have your season, and, you know, you try to schedule a game that you're probably going to win the first couple and hopefully get everybody in the game and see how they react to game situations. And then you kind of ramp it up and, you know, increase the level of your opponents, yada, 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 right? Like, there's a rhythm to the season that is gone, and it's not coming back this year. We hope it's back next year, but it is gone. Like, we started late. We had to shut down for 14 days because we had a couple cases. Who's to say it's not going to happen again? So we've really just tried to be as adaptable as we can. When I say that, not only like as we go about our daily routine, but also like in terms of how we're going to play offensively and defensively. I talked earlier about keeping it simple. We'll probably be more simple this year because I think there's going to be games where we're missing maybe our best 2-3 players. And we need kids that don't play as much to come in and play 10 or 15 minutes. And so they need to be comfortable in what they're doing if we're going to have some success. So we're really just going to try to be flexible on both ends of the floor. Try to make it fun, because it's going to, like, the drain, the mental drain that COVID has on our student athletes as well as our coaches is large. And I'm not sure that it's even measurable at times. And so really just try to keep them, you know, just stay positive. And be adaptable to all the different situations that we're going to have, and just you know, continue to teach things the ways that we've taught them and try to take our time and not rush and worry about changing things when things don't go your way. And that I think that's probably the best approach for it. And I guess hopefully it may change in January. We don't know. So we just want to play. And I know our kids are excited to hopefully get a game here at the end of the month and play against somebody other than themselves. And, you know, hopefully we're all healthy and able to do that for the duration.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I think across the board, we pretty much have to have that same approach going into this year. Definitely, just because it is a situation that is so fluid and that is just continuing to change. My last question for you is, do you have any advice for aspiring head coaches?
Aspiring head coaches. I think the first thing I always tell, and I told my former assistant who's now at Northern State, is decide if, I don't know if you know if you want to, I think you know if you want to be a head coach, but I think you have to decide if you're ready, because you're not. And that's what I told him. I said, you know, do you want to be a head coach? Said, well, I don't think I'm ready. I said, well, how do you know? Because you don't know. Like, Sammy didn't know if she was ready to be a head coach until she got thrown in the fire. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if I was ready to be a head coach. And I don't think that you ever know until you do it. And then you do it and you're not. Like, none of us are. So it's just a matter, it's more of like, do you have the growth mindset, you know, internally to understand that you don't have all the answers. Like, we all had the answers when we were assistants because it wasn't our decision. But, you know, when you're the head coach, you have to have the mindset that you're going to constantly be looking for ways to improve and refine and change how you do things or alter how you do things. And so you have to have that growth mindset if you want to be a head coach. So don't ask yourself if you're ready. Just, you know, if you think it's something that, if it's a goal of yours, then you have to do it. I think the other thing is for young coaches, it's identify what your goals are. And what I mean by that is, do I want to be a head coach or do I want to be at a certain level? And I think you have to make career choices based on that. It's so hard to move up in this profession that I think you have to decide, you know, do I want to be at the small college level, Division II, Division I, junior college, whatever. You have to kind of align your goals with your reality. And then you have to make decisions based on your goals. And that doesn't mean your goals won't change. I think that, you know, that's why we have them. And that's why we revisit them. I think any coach that gets into coaching probably gets in saying, I'm going to be a Division I coach and make lots of money and rah, rah, rah. Right. I think as you do it, as you get more involved in kids' lives and understand the differences in levels and how much time, like, you know, when I was at junior college, we could spend way more time with our kids. And even at the NAI level, we spend way more time than Division II and Division I coaches can with their kids. You know, is that what it's about? It's different for everybody. So I think you have to, you know, make sure your goals align with your realities. And then the next thing I'd tell them is to just get as much confidence as you can in teaching the system that you think you want to play when you do get your opportunity, because you have to coach what you're comfortable coaching. And I think you have to coach what you're confident in, and be able to have not only answers, but to help your kids find solutions for the problems that arise, whether with how you're playing defense or how you're playing offense. Don't just throw stuff at the wall and hope it sticks. Have a plan. Put it in your philosophy, put it into your coaching style, those types of things, because you don't want to get 3 weeks into your first practices and sit there and say, well, none of this works. because then, like I said, then you're playing catch up the whole time. And so you need to be confident in your abilities and knowing that what you're coaching is something that you can coach. I would never be someone that tries to coach like nonstop pressing, crazy, frenetic, trapping all the time, because that's not my personality and it's not something I'm comfortable with. We're going to try it at times, and we're going to, you know, for tempo change and those types of things, but that's not a base and a core of what we do. And the last thing is, and I think it's for all coaches, because I go through all the time is like when you see something that you think is really good at a clinic or online. I know we've all been watching tons and tons of webinars and all those types of things. Just remember why it's good for that person or that program. And the reason it's good is because they work at it all the time. And I think it sounds really simple, but you know, whether it's the smallest quick hitter or it's a continuity offense or a zone defense or a pressing system, the reason they're good at it is because that is where they spend the majority of their time. If you want to be good at offense, spend 70% of your practice on offense. If you want to be good at defense, do the same 70% on defense. Your kids are going to get better at the things that you practice. And it sounds really, really simple, but it's really hard to do. As you know, when you write a practice plan, you're just like, we need to work on this and this and this and this and this. And there's only so much time in that 2-hour window or however long you're practicing. So you just have to be, you know, cognizant of what you're trying to get accomplished on a daily basis. That's probably a lot of advice. It's probably too much.
No, I think it's all great. I think you touched on a lot of great points and I certainly appreciate it. Definitely stuff that I can learn from just by listening in right now. So I thank you, Coach, for being on this episode with me, for being patient for us to get a time down. But no, this has been great. I wish you all the best. I hope that you guys have the season that you have planned for. I hope that it happens and I hope that everyone stays healthy.
Same to you, Sammy. Keep doing good things and keep following you. If you have any players down there, don't be afraid to reach out.